I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Pandora has roughly 60 million users, and the service is free to listeners. Pandora is based on the Music Genome Project, a system that analyzes each song based on approximately 400 musical attributes, including harmony, instruments, or the nature of the artist's voice. Pandora has a team of musicologists who interpret each song and populate listeners' personalized radio stations with songs they might like. Tim is a jazz pianist who also has played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You graduated from Stanford in 1988, and for the next 12 years, you had a career as a musician. What were your aspirations fresh out of college?
Well, I wanted to be a rock star. That was my dream when I graduated. I didn't really know how I was going to get there, but I really left college with a real passion for music.
So even though you were trained as a jazz pianist, you wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah, jazz was really how I learned sort of harmony and theory and the piano. But as a composer and as a performer, my passion has always been for sort of rock pop music.
And who were some of your favorite, you know, rock artists whom you wish to emulate or become?
Well, it's changed over time. It's certainly the Beatles are my taproot. I love just about everything they've done, and they've been a real inspiration for me. I was a big Steely Dan fan for a long time as well. Mm-hmm. But I like everything from, you know, Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder to Fleetwood Mac to Ben Folds. Oscar Peterson's my favorite jazz musician. A pretty broad range of things.
Did you come from a house filled with music?
I came from a house full of tone-deaf people. So not a lot of musical background around me.
So how did your parents go about introducing you to the piano?
Well, it was pretty simple. I actually was living in France at the time, and I was interested in music. I took to it in school, and they just bought a piano for me. And I took some lessons from a blues pianist in Paris. And I really just took to it and started kind of teaching myself.
You had a nomadic childhood. You lived in France for a little while. Where else did you live, and what brought you to these places?
Yeah, well, I moved to France when I was 6. I lived there till I was 12, and then we moved to England, where I lived for 4 years, then went back to school in Michigan for a couple years before heading to California for college. And we moved because my dad was a businessman who worked mostly in North Africa and the Middle East and was always headquartered in Europe. He was in foods and pharmaceuticals.
You had this aspiration to become a rock star. What did you do logistically when you graduated from Stanford?
Well, the first couple of years, I actually really woodshed it as a piano player. I played piano 6-7 hours a day, really trying to hone my performing skills, and kind of gradually segued into playing with groups. So I was always a composer. I was always writing music, but I began kind of in my mid-20s playing live, and eventually I think poured most of my energy into bands, began to tour, did recordings, and really kind of lived out of a van for a while, did the whole sort of independent working musicians thing. It was certainly not something a lot of my friends and peers were doing. I think it was exciting and fun and interesting, but I think as the years went by, you certainly develop a growing sense of apprehension about whether it's going to lead anywhere.
And certainly graduating from Stanford, you could have become a consultant.
Yeah. This was not the most common career choice for my fellow graduates, for sure. And that lasted, gosh, until I was about 30. And then I kind of grew tired of the band dynamics, the sort of logistics of being one of many in a band, and became a film composer for a while.
How did you support yourself during this time? Did you make enough money composing these films or commercials?
I just about made a living doing that. I had a series of odd jobs in my 20s. I was a nanny for a while. I worked in administration at a medical school, a bunch of kind of very typical sort of musician gigs.
I don't think a nanny is a traditional musician gig for a guy.
That's true. It's not atypical for a musician. I think a lot of people are involved in that. But I did. I even played piano, you know, in hotel lobbies and things like that.
The idea for the Music Genome Project, which really is the infrastructure for Pandora, came out of your work as a composer for film. Can you describe that a little bit?
So there were really two inspirations for the genome. The genome itself definitely came from my experience as a film composer. And what happens when you're a film composer is your job is sort of twofold. One is to really be able to craft music for a certain effect, so to support picture, a scene or an emotion, a mood, whatnot. That's number one. And number two is to satisfy a director. So I got very accustomed to thinking about music and music taste in terms of musical attributes, which I think is something we all do to a greater or lesser degree. And one day I had this idea, because I'd gotten pretty good at figuring out what a director wanted. I actually would put them through kind of this musical interview, sort of the equivalent of a musical Myers-Briggs test, where I would play music for them and get their feedback and kind of glean from their answers what they wanted. And I realized that what I was doing was this genome in my head. And the idea just popped into my brain one day that, gosh, if I could codify this, write this all down, there might be a way for technology to marry it with technology to build a recommendation technology.
Incidentally, when was the Human Genome Project? Was it around this time? In 2000?
Well, I did some work actually at Stanford in the medical school for a while, and there was a lot of work being done on the human genome, so that was in my head too. But it was probably 5 years old at that point, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. At what point did this become more than just an intellectual idea where you said, you know what, I think I might have a business here?
Well, the idea percolated in my head for a few months. My wife was very supportive of it. And then one day what happened was I shared the idea with a friend of mine who had already had sort of a successful entrepreneurial experience. And his name was John Kraft. And so he said, you know, why don't we just go ahead and do it? Let's just do it. And it sort of happened suddenly after that.
What part of your shift was the acknowledgement that you were not trending towards becoming, you know, John Williams, the famous, you know, film composer, versus, you know what, I'm really psyched about this project and I'm going to take agency and make it happen?
Well, I was making sort of slow and steady progress as a film composer. But like I think virtually every musical profession, it's very hard to know if you're headed towards a good, healthy, long-term career or not. And you know, you spend most of your time really grinding away, trying to build your business, and you kind of take two steps forward, one step back. I was encouraged by where it was going, but I didn't sort of see an obvious path to a career there. But I think what really caused me to make this shift was kind of a few things. One, I really thought the idea was a good one. And there was, at the time, a tremendous amount of excitement and energy on the web in the music space. And it held this incredible promise for, you know, for changing the music industry, and this idea fit right into it. And the second thing was, I was living in the Bay Area, so I was surrounded by this kind of almost, you know, irrational exuberance for entrepreneurship. So many people were starting businesses, and there was so much investment capital around looking to fund these businesses, that it was one of those windows where, you know, if you were ever going to do it, that was the time.
Can you sum up what the Music Genome Project is?
So the genome itself is a musical taxonomy. So it's a collection of attributes, and there are about 400, that collectively describe a song. So every dimension of a recording, whether it's melody, harmony, rhythm, form, instrumentation, the vocal performance, etc., each one of those aspects is broken down into a collection of attributes, kind of like musical primary colors. Mm-hmm. So the voice has about 15 attributes just dedicated to understanding what the voice sounds like. And the idea is that you can describe just about any piece of music along the same set of attributes by just giving them different scores. It's like musical DNA.
it's people, not computers, who are kind of behind the Music Genome Project, who are looking at a piece of music and taking 20 minutes per song and analyzing it. What was your thought behind using people versus, let's say, computers to make it happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it was our single biggest liability when we started, because everybody thought this was completely insane, that we'd have a team of people analyzing songs. And you're right, it can take upwards of 15, 20 minutes, as much as an hour and a half in the case of a symphony, to complete an analysis. And the reason we did it that way was that's really the only way to do it. Machines don't have the capability of extracting that kind of data from a sound file. And the other methods for, you know, connecting songs didn't solve what was for me the most important problem, which was how to surface the stuff you've never heard before. And that's kind of where my first experience as a performer came into play, because I was really interested in finding a way for technology to help the sort of working musician, you know, the person who wasn't on a radio and didn't have a record deal. And the beauty of the genome is that it's completely blind to popularity. Mm-hmm. So we're just as adept at recommending a song from a garage band as we are from a hit artist.
I also feel like having people involved gives the Music Genome Project some heart or some subjective judgment in a way that, just having 400 criteria doesn't sound very, you know, warm and fuzzy.
Well, you know, we actually think about Pandora literally inside the company as a human being trying to figure out what you want and converse with you the same way a friend would, you know, that friend we all hope we have who knows your music taste and has this encyclopedic knowledge of music.
What is the background of the musicologists or the people, you know, behind the scenes who suggesting the music?
So they're all trained musicians. You need to have at least an undergraduate degree in music theory or equivalent to do this kind of analysis. Many of them have advanced degrees, and they're all essentially working musicians. This is their day job. They're in bands. Many of them teach. They perform. There are pianists and drummers and guitarists and people who play washboard and singers and, you know, everything in between.
It's kind of akin to the slow food movement, where it does take more time to collect data for each song, and you might have fewer songs in your library versus, you know, some of your competitors.
I like that that metaphor. It's the slow food of music. I like that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. We'll hear more from Tim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Tim is a jazz pianist who also has played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. You mentioned before how capital was coming easily to entrepreneurs in the Bay Area, and that was one of the impetuses for, you know, maybe starting your own company. The culture felt right. How easily did capital come to you when you were first launching Pandora?
So the first round of financing came relatively quickly from a small group of angel investors. It was about $1.5 million that got us off the ground, and that lasted about a year, and then it got awfully tough. We spent a number of years unable to raise money and spent a good part of that working for free and had to kind of hang on until the sort of the valley rose again in 2004 to raise a big round of investment.
It wasn't until 2004 when Larry Marcus, who was at Walden Ventures, they invested $9 million in Pandora. Is there a story of that first meeting?
Yeah, well, Larry was certainly my knight in shining armor. He actually had been following our company for a number of years, had seen us several times. And I think he's a drummer, a musician, and someone who's got a real passion for music and the sort of digital music arena. He's an investor who has long wanted to be part of this space. I think he liked the idea, and he believed that the Music Genome Project was going to have its day. And I think he also appreciated the tenacity of the team.
How different was the company that you started? How different is it from the company that it's become? I mean, some things have changed. Like, you started out with a subscription-based revenue model. Now you make most of your capital from advertising, for example. What were some other changes made?
Yeah, well, I think that this company is kind of a combination of very much the same company it was when it started. I think, the core of Pandora remains the Music Genome Project and the mission of the company, which is to help people discover music and to help bands find their audiences, has really not changed since the beginning. The front end of that mission has changed dramatically, of course. We went from being sort of a technology provider in the early years, including building kiosks for record stores, into a consumer-facing website. And as you said, we started briefly as a subscription business only, and then within a matter of weeks offered a free version of Pandora. There remains a subscription option as well, but we now look at this business as being about free advertising support to consumers.
Your name also changed. You were Savage Beast Technologies. Where'd that come from?
It comes from a Frost poem, William Congreve poem, "Music Hath Charms to Soothe the Savage Beast." It's actually "to soothe the savage breast."
It's just a misspelling.
Yeah. That would have had different implications for the company.
How did you ultimately decide on Pandora?
Well, the name, the idea came from our CEO, Joe Kennedy. And we had been through kind of a very typical process of trying to find a name for the company. And when he suggested that name, it was one of those moments when we all said, that just sounds perfect. Mm-hmm. It's the story of Pandora is about this box that, she's so curious she can't help but open. And it's full of surprises, granted, not the kind of surprises we're trying to provide people. But we love that she is insatiably curious and that you don't know what's going to come out of the box when you open it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. I want to switch gears a little bit. Songs on Pandora are suggested by not so much the wisdom of crowds or what the crowd thinks or what's most popular, but by the actual physical construct of a song. Why are you so opposed to, what's kind of popular these days, the wisdom of crowds and the community having a word in helping to form musical preferences?
So I wouldn't say that I'm opposed to it. And we actually do use our own version of collaborative filtering or kind of wisdom of the crowds in the way we interpret the thumbs up and thumbs down that people give us.
Uh-huh.
So when you thumb up or thumb down a song on Pandora, it curates your station in real time just for you. But we also collect the aggregate thumbs up and thumbs down for every song, for every station on which it plays. And we actually do use that now to help us shape stations. So
okay. It
is a piece of the puzzle. But I think the heart of your question around, why we approach this from the Music Genome Project standpoint is that, it's the one system that can really effectively surface stuff that you've never heard of before, that has no purchasing history or preference history that a collaborative filtering engine just can't grapple with. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the seminal problem of music. It always has been, it's the problem for artists as well. And I was in and among these working musicians for a long time. And the problem is, how do you sort of get noticed? And the idea behind the Genome Project was it would be the one place that was truly a level playing field, where when you came into Pandora, once you were on the system, your chance of playing was really about your sound and nothing to do with how popular you were.
You do allow musicians who are not necessarily recognized by the public or don't have record labels to upload their music and to be offered on Pandora.
We encourage it. The only prerequisite, there are two prerequisites for playing on Pandora. One is that your music is good, and that's an editorial decision that we make. And the second one is it has to be available for sale on Amazon. And that's a function of kind of how we track content on Pandora through UPC codes, etc. But really, anybody can submit their music, and you do it online through a digital process. It all gets listened to, and we pick the best stuff, regardless of you know, is the band young or old or successful or not or on a label or not or cool or not? You know, that's just not a factor. And so you'll never see Pandora, you know, cop an attitude about music. And I think, you know, partly that comes from, you know, our own musical background. You know, as a musician myself, I know how hard it is to write good music, no matter what kind. So I have a real respect for just, you know, just about anything, whether it's the most kind of packaged pop tune or some very, very atonal modern classical music. I have a sense of what goes into it, and I think we have a profound respect for that.
Pandora may not have an attitude about, you know, about music, but certainly your listeners do. Do you have an example of some criticism that your listeners might have offered you because you're not part of this popularity contest?
We do get periodic objections from people about music that we play on their stations, for sure. Some people get very offended when we select certain artists and pair them with artists that they love, and they feel somehow insulted because they think that suggestion is uncool.
What's an example?
My favorite one is an example I got from someone who had heard a Celine Dion song on a Sarah McLachlan station. I will never forget, who was very upset about it and felt that it was just, you know, very uncool for us to pair those two. But after some back and forth, they kind of really looked past the sort of cultural label and realized, well, you know, musically it kind of makes sense and I like it. It took a while for them to acknowledge that, but it was a really happy ending. As a musician, nothing drives me crazier than music snobbery. You know, it's hard enough as it is for musicians to make a living. And the last thing that they need on top of everything is to deal with, you know, people who think once they've got some degree of commercial success, they've somehow sold out and aren't worthy anymore.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. The company didn't make a profit until almost 2010. Can you talk to me about sort of the psychology of somebody who's working for 10 years and not making any money?
And I know it's pretty damaged. it's tired. Psychology is. I think that we had an incredible group of employees. I mean, really a remarkable group, both in terms of their sort of skills and talent, and also their tenacity and loyalty to the project. And I think that people never stopped believing in the basic idea. I think everyone who saw the music genome in operation and got to kind of play with the demo we had built thought it was really powerful, mm-hmm. and that we just had lousy timing, yeah. and needed to hang on long enough for it to see its day, which I think has borne out. But I think that when you go that long in such adversity, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that come into play, and probably more than anything, it's a sense of camaraderie and loyalty to each other, as much as anything that keeps you going.
Is there a loneliness at all, especially being, the founder?
Yeah, probably the most challenging part of it is you don't know if and when it's going to ever end, and you know, you're climbing a hill, but you just can never see the top, and you have no idea where it is, and that can be very discouraging. But I think when if you're one of the leaders of that mission, you just don't have the choice. You know, you need to lead by example. You need to stay positive and respect the kind of sacrifice that people around you have made on your urging,
yeah.
For so long. So you don't, in some ways, you don't really have the luxury of dwelling on the downside.
Were there ever points in that 10-year period where you thought of doing something else?
Not really. I mean, there were many times when I was, you know, very afraid that this was all going to wind up as a big smoking hole in the ground, and that a lot of people were going to be let down. I lived with that fear for a long time, but never thought I'd just stop. You know?
And you had an experience in 2007 where you were on the verge of bankruptcy, but it did confirm the loyalty of your listeners when royalty rates for playing songs increased, I think it was by the Federal Royalty Board. And with the help of a lobbyist, you really got your users on board to write letters to Congress to have the prices lowered. Talk to me a little bit about the details of that experience.
Yeah, so we went through this period of time where a ruling from the Copyright Royalty Board, which is part of the Copyright Office in Washington, essentially broke our business and broke business for internet radio, period. And in order to sort of solve that, we turned to our listeners and organized a grassroots political campaign. It was essentially asking people to call their member of Congress and object, you know, protest this and demand some kind of relief. And it was an incredible, incredible outpouring of support. It was so large and so constant that Congress actually intervened to help solve the problem, which is a really rare thing.
Despite the fact that you weren't earning significant revenue or making a profit in those 10 years, you had fierce loyalty among your employees. What's an example of that?
Years ago, when we were in some of our lowest of lows, one of our engineers who had been with us for a number of years and had been, you know, working without salary for a long time, came up to Will, our then CTO, and said, you know, I can't come to work tomorrow. I can't afford the BART ride into work. I just literally have no money left. And Will gave him $20 so that he'd come in another day. I think he wound up figuring out a way to keep working, but we were scraping the bottom of the barrel for a while.
Pandora had a turning point in 2008 with the iPhone, and the number of users increased to 35,000 users a day because there was a Pandora app offered on the iPhone. Even though you had played a role in setting this up, were you yourself surprised by the meteoric rise of adoption?
Yeah, I think we were all pretty taken aback by the velocity of that, of the mobile growth, which continues unabated now. I think there were two parts of it that surprised us and pleased us. One was just the raw increase in growth, and it almost doubled our growth rate overnight. But I think probably more importantly, it redefined our category because people began taking these devices, these mobile devices, and listening to Pandora in lots of places other than the office, which is where we had principally been listened to. So, you know, they'd take it to the gym or plug it into their car dashboard or dock it at home and stream Pandora through their stereo system. And so it was almost like overnight we went from being a sort of an at-work desktop, you know, computer radio product to something more akin to radio writ large, and we were available anytime, anywhere. And that really is the story of Pandora right now. I mean, we are a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day habit.
Now Pandora is enjoying a successful period after 10 years of really a forced march. How does it feel for you? Like, do you have an example of what that feels like?
Yeah, so I frequently have sort of out-of-body experiences now where having been, you know, in such a troubled times for so long, I often sort of pinch myself, and that happens to me fairly frequently now. One in particular, I was at an event where Joe and I were being hosted by a Wall Street investment bank who was looking to win our business so that they could facilitate a big financing round that we were doing. So we were being courted by investors, essentially, and I was at this very fancy event in Las Vegas and sitting next to this buffet table holding a truffle-infused Kobe beef burger and a very expensive glass of red wine, wondering, you know, what the hell I was doing here. And it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I remember thinking that the clock was going to strike 12 and something weird was going to happen. I was going to wind up, you know, holding a Coke and a Big Mac, or being back, you know, back at home, sweating over the company's future, and I really did sometimes wonder if I was in a dream, was going to wake up. That happens a lot.
You are running a multi-million-dollar business now. How much interaction do you have with your listeners?
So we actually decided from day one that we were going to take advantage of every opportunity to converse with people that were using Pandora, no matter what they had to say, whether it was a critique or a love letter and everything in between. And so we literally answer every single email that we get, and we get tens of thousands of them every month. And we have a team of people whose only job is just to do that. So we talk all the time with listeners.
What's the nature of some of those emails?
The emails range from you know, constructive criticism about the website to personal stories about having a baby born to Pandora, or, you know, someone who runs a funeral parlor and uses Pandora as a soundtrack, or, you know, bands people have discovered and gone to see, or, you know, ways they think we should improve the site. It's this whole, this incredible litany of advice, anecdotes, criticisms, hate mail, love letters. People send us brownies. People write music for us. It's incredible. A listener wrote in recently. Her father had just passed away, and in the sort of waning months of his life, when he was at the hospital, they had discovered Pandora and had introduced him to it, and it had apparently provided him a great amount of sort of relief and joy, you know, in the final months of his life, and he passed away listening to Pandora, and the listener wrote in just to sort of say thank you and to tell us what about this and how much it meant to her. And you know, because we know, you know, when someone dies, a hospital can give you the time of death. We were able to figure out what song was playing when he died, and we let her know what that was, and sent her a CD of it, and she played it at his funeral. That was a pretty humbling exchange to have with someone, but it's, you know, music is just such this powerful thing.
What was the song?
I think it was Vivaldi. I need to go look it up. I think it was Vivaldi.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my distinct pleasure.
My guest has been Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Coming up, we'll meet Connie Duckworth, founder of Arzu, an organization that provides economic empowerment to women in Afghanistan. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and pro bono president of Arzu, a nonprofit organization that aims to provide sustainable income to impoverished Afghan women. Arzu sources rugs from weavers in Afghanistan, sells them in the United States, and compensates these women at above market rates. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the situation that you first encountered among impoverished women in Afghanistan when you visited there in 2002?
I felt like I was stepping back in time 2,000 years. Not only is it so different culturally, but it had been a country that was subject to almost 25 years of nonstop warfare. Kabul looked like Berlin after World War II, flattened rubble. And we went into a bombed-out school building. There were literally hundreds of women and children, widows and their children, living in this shelter. To the best of their ability, they had put plastic bags over some of the gaps in the windows. There was no furniture, no water, no sanitation, no cooking facilities, nothing. And these women were surviving the winter in this building. And I looked at them, and I couldn't help but thinking, that could be me. That could be any one of us, but for the quirk of fate of where we were born. I have to say, that was the tipping point. And I came back on the plane from that first trip saying, what can I do personally to try to make some difference?
What about citizenship? Is there a lack of formal citizenship among these women?
Well, since the fall of the Taliban, there has been a concerted international and national effort to basically include women in the future of Afghanistan. And before the various wars, before the invasion of the Russians, women did have an active role as citizens in Afghanistan. There was a constitution from the 60s. Women were professionals. And because it's a gender-segregated society, 50% of the physicians were women, So they played an active role. That was all, in effect, wiped away. And you have a generation of women with no education because the Taliban precluded women from leaving their homes.
It's interesting that this disenfranchisement of women is kind of a recent phenomenon. As you were saying, 50 years ago, they enjoyed, if not equal rights to men, better rights than existed during the Taliban era. And now we're getting back to some semblance of democracy to some extent. So you're on the plane coming back from Afghanistan to the United States thinking, okay, well, what can I do? What impact can I make? Why rugs?
Well, the first idea wasn't really rugs. I kind of backed into that idea. I see the world through a business lens because of my business background. And so I naturally think that the solution to most imminent problems is economic empowerment. So I thought jobs. We're going to get these women jobs because when a woman can earn a living, it's well documented, the first thing she'll do is educate her children and then lift the community as a whole. So not knowing much about Afghanistan, I naturally thought, well, let's open some factories. Garment factory, couple of issues with that. Gee, is there electricity? No. Can you provide security? No. Is there water? No. Well, another couple of problems, the women couldn't leave their homes to go to a factory to work. So what I rapidly learned was to retreat from that ill-thought-out idea. And the bottom line we came up with is that about the only thing that women could culturally do in an acceptable way was to work in their homes. And rugs have been made by women for millennia, often with the patterns passed down from mother to daughter, often woven by memory, although the rug industry had been extremely dislocated given all the years of war. And many of the patterns were being lost. But rugs were almost the default position. It can be done in a woman's home. She knows how to do it. And it was the highest margin product I could think of because the point of all this is to kick off cash.
And what was the reaction of some of these families or of these women whom you targeted?
We go to the village elders first, and we sit down and explain what Arzu is. And we get permission to work in the village. If the elders don't want us in the village, we go to a different village. We then go to the household level. We approach the patriarch first. And if the patriarch agrees that we can work with that family, we then speak to the women. So because, again, it's gender segregated, we have a staff that involves men and women. The men talk to the men and the women talk to the women.
You mentioned that you have male monitors and female monitors, and the men talk to the patriarchs in the family, and the women speak to the matriarchs in the family. Is there ever a problem with communication between them? Can the monitors talk to each other?
When we started our expansion into northern Afghanistan in the Turkmen area, we hired a young woman monitor and a young man. Well, we'd be getting these internet reports back. And we'd look at them and there'd be these discrepancies. And we're like, what is wrong? Are they not talking to each other? Well, then we sort of said that facetiously. Turned out they weren't talking to each other. They weren't related. So therefore, they could not meet, even though they were both employed by our company, in a public place together. So we solved the problem by hiring the nephew of the woman, who also, oh, by the way, knew some computer skills, which was good. And then the three of them could meet.
Now, is this rule a vestige or a result of the Taliban rule, or is this part of the Muslim law? Where is this rule from that the men can't talk to the women?
It's really a vestige of traditional tribal customs. And it is a very religious country, so there's definitely an Islamic overlay. But the differences we see from conservative to more liberal is vast. Our area in Bamiyan, which is the central part of Afghanistan, is a very, quote, easy area for us to work in because the people there seem much more open-minded. So there we see a greater ability for men and women to be speaking together versus in the Andahoy region where religiously the people are more conservative.
So in a region like the Andahoy region, did you face resistance among families?
We did at the outset before we had any local reputation. We were we'd face families that would say no interest. And if a family didn't elect to work with us, we moved to a different household and a different family. But I will tell you, the first time we paid a bonus, because we pay a 50% quality cash bonus when the rug is completed, we were oversubscribed in that village the next day.
So those families who had resisted initially saw their neighbors getting a bonus and getting more income, and so then they signed up?
Yes. In Bamiyan, we had researched a couple of different villages to decide where we were going to start when we expanded into that area, and we selected one village. About 6 months later, we received a formal delegation of men from the other village with a written petition signed by all the elders, men and women, asking Arzu to come to their village.
You talk about men reaching out to you. Are there men weavers? Do some of the men want to weave?
It depends, again, on the tribe. If it's traditional that the men weave, we allow them to weave. We always have a master weaver, though, who is the woman.
And is there ever resentment among some of the men in these communities that the women are getting income and gaining empowerment?
Not so much within the family itself, but we have had situations where some of the middlemen that Arzu is disintermediating, we've had men who were paying women subpar rates to weave, badmouth us and go around and tell other villagers that, you know, you can't trust Arzu, don't weave for them, they don't know what they're doing.
Has your security ever felt compromised when you were there?
We have taken the approach that we want to be as local as possible and as invisible of an organization as possible on the ground. From time to time, when violence kicks up, there'll be spates, periodic spates of suicide bombings, etc. We try to monitor this random violence as much as possible, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it's a problem.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu, an organization that connects female weavers in Afghanistan with rug buyers in the United States. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. I want to talk about the economics of these rugs. How much do they sell for in the United States? What's the range?
The range, depending on size and pattern, of course, is between roughly $1,000 and $15,000.
How much is the weaver seeing?
There's a going labor rate for weaving rugs. So we'll pay the high end of the market rate plus 50% of that. Normally, a woman would go into debt to purchase materials that she would then use her labor to weave the rug. And then she'd turn the rug over to someone else who would charge her to finish the rug and then would go sell it. And at the end of the process would come back and say, here's your money. What we've done is we provide the highest quality materials. We've also systematically gone through and replaced looms or provided looms. A loom is, in effect, her biggest capital asset. And I'd say maybe one or two out of 100 weavers might have actually owned a loom. What we, in effect, are doing is taking her from a risk position as an entrepreneur and converting her into a salaried employee so that she has a dependable income that we pay not at the end of the process but throughout the process so she can put food on the table today.
You also are supplying other benefits to these women and their families, such as health care and education. Can you describe that a little bit?
That's the literacy classes that we're establishing in the village. That's the basic access to health care. It's transportation to clinics and hospitals for pregnant women. We've built a school in one village. We've looked at water catchment systems, and we're undertaking the construction of one of those because water is a very big area. We've been researching alternative livelihood. What that really means is jobs for men in the village. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some small food processing plants. All of the proceeds from the sale of rugs here goes to support the entire closed-loop Arzu system. So all of the money from a particular sale does not go directly to a particular woman, but funds all of the projects.
What's an example of a woman who has benefited from Arzu?
So one of our earliest weavers was a widow named Hamida. And Hamida happens to have two daughters who are the ages of my two daughters. Hamida was a widow. She was a refugee in Pakistan, suffered greatly, and she started weaving for Arzu. When Hamida, a year after starting our literacy classes, and everyone, when we started literacy classes, was in grade one. Didn't matter if you were 50 or 12 or 25. She said, learning to read was like a blind woman getting her eyes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and president of Arzu. Prior to starting Arzu, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs, where she worked for over 20 years. Connie is also the author of The Old Girls Network, a book for female entrepreneurs and businesswomen. How did you raise capital for Arzu?
Well, I funded the first 18 months personally. We'll call that friends and family money. Then we applied for a seed grant from USAID, the Agency for International Development. USAID invested over a three-year period a total of $2 million.
How does one find an Arzu rug?
Well, the best place to go is to our website, which is arzurugs.org. And Arzu, by the way, means hope in Dari, and it's also a common woman's name. Dari is one of the many tribal languages in Afghanistan.
So I want to talk about your prior professional history. You were at Goldman Sachs for 20 years.
That's right.
But while you were at Goldman, you led kind of an entrepreneurial life to some degree within Goldman Sachs. What is an example of a project that you started within Goldman?
Well, I was tapped in 1990 probably by Bob Rubin to start a diversity initiative. Now, sitting here today in 2007, you think, well, what's so novel about that? At the time, that was not a word that was widely utilized, certainly not in Wall Street, but anywhere in corporate America. It was an undefined term. And so I was told to start this, and I had no idea what this was. But over the next 5 years, we basically implemented all of the family-friendly type policies, job sharing. We had the first daycare backup center in Wall Street in New York, where people whose child care fell through could bring their child, man or woman, bring their child for the day. Maternity, adoption leave. So really, all of the kinds of policies that help improve the workplace and the work environment.
You mentioned that Bob Rubin came to you. He became later the Secretary of Treasury during the Clinton administration. I've heard that he said, "I hear you can get things done." Why did you have that reputation at Goldman, do you think, for getting things done?
Well, I think it comes from having grown up in the bond department, which is for those who ever read Liar's Poker, that book from the 80s, it was very much transaction-based. And so we were trading hundreds of millions of dollars of securities in a single trade at a single moment. And so execution was paramount.
Now, in addition to word of mouth and having people just go to your website to buy the rugs, you've also had cocktail parties at Goldman Sachs, for example, where you have all women of all ages come and buy these rugs.
Oh, yes. The firm has been very supportive and also is the proud owner of some Arzu rugs for the executive floors. One of the benefits of having a long business career is that it gives me a good Rolodex, and I have been quite shameless in levering that Rolodex to ask people for help.
After you left Goldman, in addition to starting Arzu, you also wrote a book called The Old Girls Network, which tries to help women entrepreneurs and women in corporate America kind of deal in a man's world. What were some of the issues that you faced being a woman at Goldman Sachs?
When I first got out of business school, and was even applying for jobs, I was still being told, now this is ancient history, but in the late 70s by some of the companies that I interviewed with that, well, we don't hire women. Now, you definitely wouldn't hear that one today, but I would say basically I've typically been the only woman in the room. And now I sit, from a business perspective, I sit on several corporate boards, and that seems to now be, at least in popular press, one of the last bastions of male-dominated business arenas.
It's striking to me and this might seem ridiculous at first, the similarities almost between the women you're trying to empower in Afghanistan and the women you've tried to promote here in the United States, whether it's through your book or through Goleman, just this notion of financial independence.
I think that's a very interesting observation because I do very much see the linkage. I have come to believe over the course of my career that there's a dignity that comes with work. I think that, and I see it in Afghanistan, I think the right to work and to have a value placed on your work is really a basic human need and a basic human right.
In your book, I was struck there was a female pioneer venture capitalist receiving an award, and she comes up on stage onto the podium to receive the reward. And she said, "Does this microphone work for women too?"
I have a little personal saying, which is, "She who writes the check controls the agenda." And I think that's true in politics. I think it's true in business. I think it's true in every venue.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.